welcome to Get Up, Get Up. It's another Friday. We've made it through the week again. It's
again,
a little time of two old men kind of yelling at each other and talking to people. I'm Greg Gnip. Of course, I'll be the Gnip. There's my good friend, my brother from another mother, Chris Yuzinski. Of course, he is Gnip. How are you, buddy?
It's been such a great week. You know, I can't complain.
That's good. That is a good thing. I mean, we need more.
Good weeks.
Weeks around. I mean, let's see if we can do two in a row. Yeah. Come on, two in a row.
Let's have another lockdown. Come on, everybody. Everybody dance.
And of course, you know, this week we lost two big names in the entertainment world. Ronnie Spector passed away on Wednesday at the age of 78 from cancer, of course, from the Ronettes and the song probably best known for Be My Baby.
Okay.
And then actually somebody that I met and was a huge fan of, Bob Saget, passed away about a week ago. About five, six days ago. And at he was only 65 years old, which is, that's young. That's young. And you know, the thing is, it was really funny. So I met him because I had to do an interview with him because he was at the Royal Oak Music Theater.
Okay.
And his press agent comes on. She's like, "All right, Greg Gnip, you have exactly 10 minutes for the interview and no more time. I will come in at 9 and tell you when to wrap it up." And he gets on and he goes, "All right," starts things off. We do the interview. She comes on and he goes, "Listen, I pay her. This has been a lot of fun. Let's talk some more." Nice. 25 minutes we talked. I pushed all the other interviews back and stuff like that. He's like, "Sorry, are you going to be coming to the show?" And I'm like, "No, I didn't get tickets. I'm sorry. I didn't even think of it, blah, blah, blah." He goes, "Oh, okay. That's too bad." 5 minutes later, the one who was kicking me off the interview, she calls me up and she goes, "Mr. Saget would like to have you at the show."
Oh, nice.
"And will you make sure that you leave some time to go backstage to meet him?"
Yeah.
And I was just like,
"Put your good pants on."
And he was just a real, and then of course he was just full of potty jokes the whole time. Didn't he always say he was a 9-year-old kid in an old man's body?
I've heard wonderful things about him all week from his different friends and people who worked with him, and what an amazing guy and lots of love, and he was always positive. And he always had that great dad image too, right? Because of his TV show, and then of course America's Funny Home Videos. Every little kid grew up with Bob Saget, you know, kind of introducing the videos, you know, the days before YouTube. And but what was really crazy was if you ever saw his live show, it was a potty fest.
Oh,
you know, it's like seeing Don Rickles. You know, it was just a total potty fest. Going like these don't match up in my mind, but that was part of his shtick, right?
Oh yeah, and he did it so well, and then he would talk about it. You know, one of the things that I always thought was kind of funny, and it was because he always talked about his kids, right, and that how they would be so embarrassed with some of the things he would say on stage,
right.
But then as he would say, he'd go, "And that's why you're driving a nice car."
Exactly.
But you know, it's too bad. He was a really nice man. I have to say, out of all the, I've had a chance to meet so many different musicians and different actors and actresses and people, thanks to, you know, working in radio. He's the one guy that always sticks out in my head about being truly a cool interview.
Nice.
You know, like you could tell that he actually cared about, the guy that was talking to him.
And it's rare. It's rare. A lot of those people are just pure assholes. I got to tell you, with all due respect to everybody out there, there's a stage presence, there's a person presence, and you know, very rarely do the two kind of correlate.
Yeah.
You know, because the stage presence is that. It's just their persona. But it's great to meet someone like that and just really respect them for them being a great human being, not just for what they do.
No, without a doubt. And I agree. And it really is too bad because, you know, he had, he had a lot more years in him that he could have, you know, hopefully it would have been nice to make more people laugh, because that is one thing we need in this world right now is some good laughter.
I know. So,
I was going to say, and good music.
Yes. So we've got a real great special guest on the show today, who's an old friend of ours. I don't want to bring him in just yet, but I do want to say a couple things about next week. Next week we have, I'm really excited about this, we have David J. Haskins from Bauhaus and from Love and Rockets. He's going to be on talking about his new project that he's got going on. And, of course, going to talk about Pat Fish, because he was in the Jazz Butcher Conspiracy for a short period of time. So we're going to talk about the late, great Pat Fish. And then we get to talk about all those great goth stories about Bauhaus back in the early 80s, which is just going to be... I'm like a kid.
Incredible.
It's gonna be great.
Yeah,
it's gonna be great.
Oh yeah, I'm giddy. Is it wrong to say that I'm tingling right now?
Absolutely. It's totally wrong. So anyway, the one thing that we are gonna do is we're gonna kind of cross the borders and go across. We're gonna go to Spain and we're gonna go visit with an old friend by the name of John Stokes. But before that, I just want to show you a little bit of what John's been up to. Hey, come on, it's amazing.
That is. That's
it's the Quartetto Breton. That's our old friend John Stokes, who we knew back in the early 80s as a principal cellist of the Windsor Symphony Orchestra, and then he just magically kind of left us by the time the 90s came around to go become the principal cellist of a fine orchestra in Madrid, Spain. So welcome to Gnip Gnop, our old friend John Stokes.
Hola y bienvenido, señor. I just thought I'd make you feel a little bit more comfortable.
Did he just tell you to go wash your car?
Muchas gracias.
it's been so great reconnecting with you. And I know that you were always my classical buddy when you're in Windsor, because
everybody has to have one.
Yeah. You were the guy who kind of brought me back into classical music that I grew up to as a kid, because we all grew up watching Bugs Bunny, and that's how we know opera, and that's how we know classical music, right? Because it was that great conduit, kind of bringing us comedy and great music, and God, there's so much I want to talk to you about from a classical music standpoint. You know, but really want to talk to you about your journey, because
can we just before we start the journey, though, we have to explain something. So okay. You always think of what a classical musician is. They're in their tuxes, they're dressed up all the time, and they have a certain look. Mm. And we would get to see John Stokes performing in his tuxedo.
Yes.
In his, you know, he was always well dressed, and this lovely red flat top.
Right. Bright red flat top.
Thank you.
And it would always be that look where you'd go, it didn't matter. You'd walk in and go, oh, there's John.
There's Stokesy.
It was always fantastic, because you always stood out so much. It was just the greatest thing.
And it also didn't hurt that you were like 6'4", and you were the first guy in the first position of the orchestra, right?
Yeah, at the front, right?
Yeah, right at the front.
Right, but I rocked that flat top.
You bet.
I used to get stopped when my university days in Philadelphia. I got stopped by homies, right? And they'd be just like, oh, damn, man, look, you're rocking that box, man. Where'd you get the box? And so I just had to have it. But the funny thing is that was my signature, you know, that kind of look. And so they started asking me, hey, do you mind being on the poster for this year's season? I'm like, yeah, sure, okay. And then my buddy would say, hey, in San Francisco would say, I just ran into somebody from Canada, and they said that they interviewed you like a month ago in Windsor. So it's funny that I'm just like my guy doing my job. I go home, I practice, I go out at night, I go to Detroit or whatever like that. But people recognize me, and it was so funny. Then living in Windsor and being, you know, kind of this guy, just like, oh yeah, Stokes.
Yeah. How did you leave Windsor? Because this is fascinating. How'd you get where'd you get
to? I came to Windsor in 88.
Yep.
And after about 4 years, I was thinking, well, maybe I should develop my career because, you know, it's great to be, this is a great opportunity being principal cello here. But, you know, I had this kind of like a Russian 5-year communist plan. Every 5 years, I would go to another orchestra, I'd go to another orchestra and just keep on changing.
World domination.
Yeah. And so then I heard, you know, there's a place called the Banff Center of Fine Arts. Right. And so I applied there in, I think it was the summer of 92. And so I got an audition. I went to Toronto and I had an interview and I played. And my project was just to go there, develop myself, study, prepare for auditions and stuff like that. And surprisingly enough, I got accepted. So that meant I would, you know, they just accept you there for 8 months in the mountains and you have your own studio. And so they would have these interesting guests. So we were artists in residence, and they had these interesting guests, these master players. And a guy came, a concert cellist came named Luis Claret, who was living in Barcelona, well, outside of Barcelona. And I took a lesson with him. He was there for 9 days. I took three classes with him. And he would hear me playing, and he said, in his English, because he spoke six or seven languages, he said, "Your sound is very much like rusty car brakes." And I was like, "Thanks, guy. Thanks. What a great guy." And so he said, "Why don't you try this?" And he said, "Why, instead of trying to grab the notes, why don't you use your back? And why don't you do this?" And without knowing what I was doing, it sounded better. And I'm like, how can I not know what I'm doing and it sounds better? This guy knows something. So I tried to pick his brain. We went out for drinks and all that kind of stuff. And afterwards, I wrote down everything. And afterwards, I thought, I have to go and meet this guy and study with him in Barcelona. And so I wrote him and I said, "Hey, I got back to Windsor and I said, hey, I want to study with you." And so he said, "Sure, come here." So I just basically, I got my British passport because my dad was English, and that allowed me to live there. And I sold all my stuff. I sold my car, my stereo, and everything. And I said, I'm going there. And so I wanted to learn this technique, but I wanted to become European because to me that sounded, you know, as a Canadian, that sounded like a very romantic kind of thing. So I was there and I studied with him intensely for 6-7 months. But I ran out of money, and so I heard of a job from a Toronto Canadian who was in the Orchestra Sinfonica de Tenerife in the Canary Islands. And he said, "There's a co-principal job, make a tape, get invited here to work, and stay here for the audition." So I did, and 2 months later, I won the job. So that's basically how I was able to, you know, get a living and doing what I, you know, what I love.
Wow.
See, and that is just a great example. And I'm just going to say this. It's like, hey, kids, you know what? If you got to work midnights, it's really not so rough. This guy had to sell all his stuff, and then he decided to go across half the world to go and to, you know what I mean? What a great story. That's incredible.
No, but you're absolutely right. If you have your axe, you know what I mean? Like a musician has their axe, or a singer, you know, they found their axe in their life. If you found your axe, whatever it is, you have to be true to yourself and go for it. Because the only thing, don't disappoint yourself by not trying. You have to go, because when I was in the Royal Conservatory doing an orchestra training program between 87 and 88 in Toronto, there was other guys, other cellists that people were like, "Man, this guy, this young guy, you know, he's 20, he's really hot, man, he's got the stuff, he's playing so well." Most of those guys never went anywhere because they didn't do the work, the groundwork, because they were so good kind of naturally, or they started so early and they just kind of petered out and never went anywhere. And so here's a guy, what I had, you know, regular amount of talent or whatever, but I just worked hard and I just wouldn't stop. And I'd be taping myself and out practicing 5-6 hours a day. You know, you just really have to keep at doing it and doing it. And over the years, you just get, you know, the calluses, you get the repertoire into your hands, and you just can be, okay, I'm going to do another audition. I did auditions for the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, the BBC North, the BBC Scottish in Glasgow. I did all these auditions, and, you know, finally I won the one that I won, and I'm here in Madrid. So I feel incredibly unfortunate in my career that I've been able to do I'm more than most people could like dream about, and I feel very, very lucky about that.
And you've been there for what, like 26 years?
Yeah, I've been in Spain since 94, so that's it'll be 28 years in August.
Okay. Nice.
So when did the accent start?
What, my English accent speaking Spanish or my Spanish accent speaking English? In a moment before the show, I was telling Chris that people sometimes, after all these years, I'll start speaking Spanish to them, obviously, because I'm in Spain, and they'll start speaking their like mediocre level English to like help me, like in a store or something like this, thinking that they're, oh, this guy can't speak English. I'm like, listen, dude, and you know, I'll say in Spanish, listen, dude, I've been here 28 years. I can like speak all you want. It's funny. But it's basically for the accent, because English people have a very difficult, because my father's English and, you know, I'm Canadian and stuff. So people who speak English have a very difficult time to get that kind of like, este tipo de inglés, where you speak, sabes, Spanish, you get, you know, you just never get rid of it.
John, there's always sign language.
Yeah, right.
Or Google Translate. Yeah,
that's right.
Hey, what are you drinking, by the way? Because I see your glass is empty.
Your viewers don't mind to do some plugging.
Okay.
This is, okay, Legado de Farro. And this is from Mencia, which is part of the region called, Castilla y León. And so I got into that wine from that region because I knew the owner of a bodega or a vineyard. And I just saw this at the supermarket. So I saw this at the supermarket, and it was $5 Canadian. So, because
cheap like borscht.
Yeah, here you can buy wine for €2, 175, 190, something. But if you go, you know, above €3, you know, it's going to be good. It's crianza. It'll be in the barrel for, you know, 18 months. You know, you can get actually really good wine. That's I mean, here in Spain, that's things like primary resources in food, such as like olive oil, virgin olive oil, wine, cheeses. You would love Spain as for the food. All northern Spain is just in insane regions of different types of food and fish and meat and that.
See, and one of the things I love is what you said about, you know, the cost of wines and thing, right? And I said, I have a friend of mine who, you can't be much cheaper than this person. Like, we'll ask for 3-for-1 deals, things like that. Went to visit some friends in France and ended up doing the, I'll save money. Really? Everyone else is buying wine? I'm going to drink a Coca-Cola. And the wine was like $2 a piece. Right. And the Coke was $4.50. And he was like, what? And they're like, I always drink the wine.
Yeah. Well, these wine producing countries, you know, the wine is actually cheaper, can be cheaper than water.
God bless them.
Yeah. I got Sleeman's Honey Brown, what's left of it, because it's so good.
Oh, man. Memories.
Yes. And it's in a keg in my office. So I just, you know, kind of. Sorry.
It's handy.
It's really handy. It's disgustingly handy. But yeah, such a beautiful color, such a wonderful solid beer.
And thanks to you, Chris. I'm finishing up a bottle of the Evan Williams eggnog, because today is New Year's. Happy New Year's to my Orthodox friends.
Orthodox friends.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so
today
is
today. Year. Oh, man. Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, happy New Year's, everybody.
Yeah, so I'm drinking eggnog.
So,
well, because my girlfriend is Orthodox, so I should say, I should congratulate her.
Maybe you should. Did you wish her a Merry Christmas a week ago?
Let me write that down.
That's awesome.
Maybe you should. Hey, John, you know, a couple months ago, we had a dear friend of ours, buddy Manoilovich, on, and it was an interesting interview.
Start again. How do we fix it? So the fix was at this, at that, at this, at that.
He's talking about his Bubby
That's
sauce.
That's how Bubby sauce the famous came to Bubby. Be.
Wow.
And so it was only designed as to be, and the thought was, if we cut this with some yogurt to even further reduce it, there would be our salad dressing. And right. So the salad dressing had to be cut with yogurt because it was so potent. And then the concept came about to, why don't we put this on top of the burgers as a topping, you know, like mayonnaise, like a condiment. The idea became, well, we'll take this as a condiment, put it on the burgers. So that's how Bubby's Sauce came to be, by total, you know, overindulgence and a little extra heavy hand on garlic and some creative thinking on how to fix. And then, you know, the idea to use it as a condiment on the burgers. Well, over time, that condiment, people started asking for it. And I remember one gentleman I became to befriend, he was actually he was a professional cellist in the Windsor Symphony. And he doesn't live in Windsor anymore, but he would come in and Stokesy? He would ask for a bowl of Bubby's and his fries.
That sounds like
and
Stokes.
And that whole fries and Bubby's thing, again, actually the customers sort of brought that on. They, you know, the idea of the mayonnaise with the fries. And so customers started catching on to this Bubby's and fries thing. And then it's really interesting, like I say, to me, I'm blown away about how Bubby's became more and more of this utilized condiment throughout all the different foods that we were carrying. And like I say, it's the customer driving the inspiration on even how to use it.
So, buddy, are you...
It's just, it's funny. You
but
know?
Are you, buddy, are you saying John Stokes is the guy who...
Yes, it's John Stokes. Yeah, absolutely.
That's incredible.
Who watches the show, by the way, from Spain. There you go. Dude, you're famous in Windsor. There you go.
No, that's amazing that he...
You left your mark.
Remember that.
You left your mark.
Yeah. It was amazing because I used to live right behind the theater. What was that theater called right down?
The Cleary Auditorium.
That's it. That was my first place that I lived. That was just a stone's throw from the fish market. And so I found this place and I started going there for lunch. And then we would go, you know, the musicians, we always went to, you know, between rehearsals, we'd go there to eat. But it was just too much. You know, I eat hamburger and fries and a couple beers, and I just couldn't do the afternoon rehearsal. It was just too much. So I started thinking, well, I love this place. The sauce is incredible. And so I just started doing, well, I'm going to do it light. I'm going to go vegetarian. So I said, give me a big plate of those wedgie fries, sprinkle it full of cheddar cheese on top, and give me like two of those bowls of Bubby sauce. And so after a few months of doing that, people I noticed that other people were eating it as well.
I'm sure the conductor really appreciated that for the afternoon rehearsal.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I had as much space as I needed to play. That's for sure.
I'm sure they gave you all the space you wanted, John.
Right. That's right, because if you've never tried Bubby's sauce, people know you've eaten Bubby's sauce 2 days later.
Yeah.
That's right.
The bus going by knows you ate Bubby's sauce. Yeah.
Wow.
So John, you have your principal instrument is obviously one of your most expensive investments, not just in your career but in your personal life, because a cello is worth a lot of money to a professional player, and you have a famous person's cello.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, it's kind of a coincidence that I have Sir Elton John's cello. Because a friend of mine who's a luthier, which is a guy who makes and fixes instruments, and he as well invested in instruments and went to Sotheby's and to London to go to the auction in Sotheby's to buy instruments. And he went and bought this instrument of Sir Elton John, which is a copy of a Matanhada, a copy of an instrument that's actually in São Paulo in Brazil, which is from 1732. And it's like this insane copy that looks exactly like it, with all the bang-ups, all the scratches, all the wear off of the varnish. And when other luthiers, people who make instruments, look at this, they just look up, put their hands on their head, they're just like, oh my God, this is so much work. How could somebody do that much work and put it in to make it look like an exact copy? So I was actually buying my friend Jorge Porthas. I was going to buy his cello. Which is like 1820 in this German great sounding instrument. But at the end of the day, he decided not to. And so I said, well, you're going to have to sell me the other one, because if you're going to like screw me on this one, you're going to have to sell me the other one. He's like, well, I'm going to sell that one to somebody else. I'm like, no, you're not. You're going to sell it to me. We're going to have problems. And so I bought it. I just sold my apartment. And so I had the cat, I had, you know, the money. So I was able to buy it. And it's a great instrument because it's like 1997. but it looks like an old instrument. And I don't know if you know this, but nowadays there are like these incredible instruments being made by, you know, new instruments made by these master luthiers that when you put them next to great instruments, you can actually have difficulty telling the difference because of the quality of the sound. And so I feel very fortunate because if I was going to buy a better instrument, once you get to a certain level, you just have to like double it. So instead of putting, you know, whatever, you'd have to pay 100,000 or 200,000 or 300,000, and just like it just keeps on doubling, right? So that's well, here's a fun, interesting talking about great instruments. My quartet, we've had the fortune of playing in the Royal Palace in Madrid on their Stradivarius collection. So they actually have, it's the only Stradivarius string quartet, so two violins, a viola, and a cello that were made for each other to be played as a string quartet, and they look like each other. So the cello, I think the cello's from like 1723 or something like that, and it's insane because they're behind glass, and so they only get used 5 times a year or 4 times a year. So they're in unbelievable condition, and it's, well, I don't know. I don't know if it's like you guys were driving a McLaren or something. I don't know. You know, like a McLaren car, you know, something that, you know, it's just like the top of the top. It's like the racehorse of instruments kind of thing.
Worth millions, that collection, I'm
Oh
sure.
yeah. I mean, if you can imagine, the cello would probably be worth each instrument would be worth at least between 3 and 5 million euros, and then together
Euros.
euros. Yeah, but if that's nothing, because together, since it's not even, you couldn't even put a price. How could like four instruments of Stradivarius that are made to be together? I mean, you could name your price. If together they'd be worth 20 million as individuals, it might be worth 50, 100 million, because there's it's unique. There's no other set like that in that condition in the world. But anyway, that
So,
was
so how, so I'm going to ask you, so how, as a principal cellist, how many cellos do you have?
I used to have four. It's kind of something that you collect. The like I had what did I start with? Okay, I had my cello from university, which was an Austrian cello from 1716, and I took that over from I had that in Windsor, and I brought it over here, and I won my first job with that. And then I bought like a second instrument, kind of a Chinese instrument, so that I could like play outside or gigs outside, you know, in inclement weather or something like that. And then I had an opportunity to buy an Italian, like mid-20th century instrument, and I bought that. And then this one came along, and this was, I was like, that's the cello I want to play on. So I bought this cello. It's well, it's a guy named Roger Graham Hargreave, and the one that I was telling you about, you know, that was actually, how do you say it in English? It was an encargo, which means Sir Elton John asked this luthier to make this cello for him, right? And so then he sold it and through Sotheby's, and that's how I arrived at getting it. But that's my, you know, forever cello. It's like until the end of my career.
Now, do you keep your eyes and ears open to see if there's another cello coming up that might be that next one,
No,
or are you
no.
good right?
No, I because I had to decide, do I want to buy an apartment? Do I want to stop renting, or do I want to spend the rest of, because like I said, if the instrument, if I would have to go to 70 or 100,000 euros to buy something that actually sounds better, because worth is not the way it sounds, right? It's the pedigree, you know what I mean? And so trying to get something that sounds that much better, why you're doubling the price or something, it's just like, well, do I want to like be, you know, be poor and renting an apartment, or, you know? So I started getting into property and buying, and you know, by having an apartment and, you know, being an owner and stuff like that.
Hey, John, just a quick question about classical music, and I know this is kind of a bigger question. You know, there's the greats, right, that we talked about, like with the Bugs Bunny. Like there's the greats, the greatest hits of classical music that everybody
Oh yeah,
knows.
like the top 40. Yeah,
Sure,
sure.
sure. And then there's a lot of the modern classical, and some of it, you know, as a classical fan, some of it's really tough. Like, it's just
really tough.
It's real, and I don't mean that in a negative way, because people love it. Lots don't, but it's so. I'm losing words. I'm trying to explain this. It's so aggressive. It's so
abstract.
It's not just the abstractness, but even the technical side of it is just so like over the top. Like, it's just, how do you play 100 notes in a minute?
There was what a metronome is, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And so if a metronome is going at 60, that's one pulse per second.
Right.
Well, I had to play a contemporary piece where I was playing over 1,000 per beat, right? I was playing.
Huh?
It was like I had to pay, like, in a second, I had to pay. How many notes I had to have to play? I had to play like 12 or 16 notes in a second, so or and more. So, like, physically impossible. And so it's just like, and so it's incredibly stressful, needs an incredible amount of preparation. And right. then you have to play together with other people. Like, in my string, we play a lot of contemporary music in my orchestra, but in my string quartet, we play a lot of Spanish contemporary music. And we premiered the 10th string quartet of Christoph Hofter, who died not too long ago. He was 89 or 90 and stuff, and his music was so difficult that he apologized to me on the phone when I talked to him. He just says, like, I'm really, like, usually he would never say anything because he's like an international, you know, Spanish star, you know, of classical music, of the, you know, of the grandfather. He's like the godfather. You know, the godfather of Spanish contemporary music. and he was apologizing to me, and I was surprised. I'm like, no, it's okay, maestro. It's okay, it's okay. No, it's really, it's really even more difficult than I ever do. And that's why one of the concerts that we played on the Strads was playing that. And it was, it was insane, because we're playing. But then there would be like accelerandos going forward with the tempo, going backwards and rubatos. And so it was like, it was almost impossible. So it can be gratifying when you play it well, but the amount of work that you have to do, it can be, as you get older, it can get kind of tiring. Like, oh yeah, okay, another time I'm going to be doing this kind of work. And it can get tiring. Of course, one gets better at being sight reading it and putting fingerings in and deciphering the music. It is really difficult.
What is gratifying after 30 years of doing this?
What is gratifying personally for me is the string quartet, which is my own personal vehicle to do the kind of projects, like the four of us decide. It's not like I'm like some small cog in a big machine that's a symphony orchestra where there's 80 or 90 people, and, you know, the concert master's my boss, the music director's my boss, whoever who comes and is an invited director's my boss, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so what I have to say, or my input, doesn't have that much to say to the end result. But in the quartet, what I have to say, and we talk about the music and we discuss about it in my quartet, you know, I'm 25%, because we're four, I'm 25% of the group. So what my input has a lot more to do with what the output is.
So I have a question, though, and this is something that I've always wanted to ask, is the conductor.
Mm-hmm.
When you've got a symphony of 65, 70 people, 80 people, right?
Mm-hmm.
How important is the conductor really? And I know that sounds terrible to say,
no.
But with that being said,
it's a good question. It's a good question. It's really a good question, because when you see a live orchestral program, a concert on the television, they look very important, because what they're doing is just like, oh wow, they're really energetic, and they're giving, you know, they're giving cues to people, and they're doing the rhythm and stuff. The role of the music director developed from, you know, the 1600s, when Lully in France would beat out with his big baton on the floor, bang, bang, and he would like bang, because they had like 30, 40 people playing Baroque instruments and harpsichord and stuff like that. And so they needed somebody to bring them together, right?
Right.
And as you get more and more people and you're getting into works by Richard Strauss, Wagner, Mahler, there could be 100 people, 110.
Sure.
There'd be so many people on stage that, you know, there's some guy out there who's like, you know, 20 meters away, and he has to, when you give a sign like that, it has to get to him, and he has to play in time and make all those allowances, right? Because if he was just listening, he could only hear the people around him. So the harp players who might be playing beside the French horn players, they don't hear anything, because all they hear is French horn. And so they have a kind of skewed version of what's happening with the music. So they are very important, but the older you get, the slyer you get. Like me, I just use the director as a starting point, you know? He'll just go, and you just start, right? And so from that point, I start listening. So the older you get, the more experienced you get, you listen more. So you're not just listening to yourself. Then you start to go, it's kind of like that, open your mind, you know, or that, with that Tom Cruise movie. What was that one? But that one where he is like, don't be one mind, be one mind. The Last Samurai. Remember that movie?
Yeah.
And when he's in the little village up in the mountains, and the guy says, one mind. Well, you have to, like, first of all, deal with yourself, the section, the people around you, like the strings, and then you start going to winds, brass, and everybody. Right. And so if you can listen to everybody, because as a principal cellist, I have to make decisions, because a music director doesn't play one, two, three, four. It's one, two, three, four. So when they hit the up part is actually where the pulse sounds, because of the delayed reaction of the orchestra, what he does. So it's, and sometimes when he might give like a boom, for an entrance, it might be more on the beat. So you're always making decisions about how far behind the beat are you, but listening to everybody else. So if the violins are playing, but then there's a brass chorale, you know, you can't fight against, you know, 20 or 15 or 20 brass players doing a huge brass chorale. So you have to follow them. Or if there's like the timpani is playing along and just laying down the rhythm, you can't be going along with the second violins that are like maybe off from them. So it takes a lot of experience in opening your ears. So, I mean, it all depends, because a lot of directors that come by, and maybe you don't need them so much or something else, but then sometimes somebody comes along, like when Lorne Massel, who was like, I mean, he was getting paid 100,000 euros to conduct a show every time, right? And this guy, he came, his assistant came, prepared us, and then we did the show, Le Martirio de San Sebastian, but the Martyrdom of San Sebastian by, I think it was Debussy, and we did it with this crazy kind of show and ballet and stuff, and we were in the pit, and he came, and it was magical, because he barely moved, but everything was just so, you know, he just gave you the feeling of how the music should be. And the greater they are, it's like the less they do, but the more expressive they are with their hands. So, I mean, there are people out there. I notice at the first rehearsal, you, as soon as somebody comes along who really knows what they're doing and is really good, nice, you'll just go, oh shit, you know, I got to pay attention. Because this guy, we had, you know, like, we're playing, was it Firebird Suite by Stravinsky? And so it starts off really low with the basses and the cellos going, like very ominous and just eerie. And so we started, and he didn't even give an up by, he just started, and we played. He cut, he said, please, notas, false notes, no. He stopped us after three notes. And criticized us for bad notes or playing out of tune. And we were like, his name was Karabchevsky. From, and he was a god to me. He was like my god. I worshiped that guy, because we wouldn't even rehearse stuff when we go to concert, and he would be just with a Mendelssohn II double piano concerto, and we didn't even rehearse the fourth movement in the dress rehearsal, and he was just like in the concert, giving like so much control, like in real time. It was unbelievable.
John, next time you come on the show, and you should come on again, maybe next time you can play for
please.
Us.
Please. I'll bring another wine.
Let's do that. Let's do that for sure, my friend. Anyway, we got to go. And thanks for joining us, and all the best.
What a pleasure. What a pleasure to
Madrid,
see you guys
Spain,
after
my friend.
So long.
Good to see you too,
hopefully
man.
Hopefully one day we can all get together again and we can hoist a glass of wine, a beer, and a shot of tequila.
All of them.
All the above. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
We'll see you, John.
Thanks, Greg. Bye, kid.
That's it for Ganip Ganop. Hey, Greg, we got to go. We got to go.
And
next
week, we
gotta
get out of
here. David J.
John Stokes, always, that's good to see him.
Yeah, for sure. See you next week, everybody, with David J. from Bauhaus.
Woohoo!